Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome to the Box Set Pod, a Box Set Pod special, which could also be called a Creative Kale special, if you've heard any of those. I'm joined by a very special guest. His name is Tom Leonetti
Maguire.
So Leonetti clearly comes from lion.
Yeah. So it's my sort of it's my grandfather's name. It's like my mum's family name.
Italian.
Yes, Italian, comes from southern Italy. It actually means little lion. Hence, Little Lion Entertainment. That is our company. Yeah.
Wow.
There you go.
So you had a chip on your shoulder from a young age about having to be a little lion.
Just about being Italian-Irish as well, I suppose.
Yeah. What a mix.
I know.
What a mix of passions. Celtic passion and Italian passion.
Yeah.
So you've got excellent taste and you can sing really well as well.
No, I can just, like, drink a lot.
You can do Guinness or wine.
Or limoncello.
I should introduce Tom. Tom has done something incredible. Tom, not many people, when they die, will be able to say, I did something with my time that is worth pride. and Tom did. Tom, has it? I'll let Tom. So Tom, what have you done?
What have I done again? I wouldn't go that far.
But don't be British about it. Be Italian about it.
Okay.
What is the most grandiose
fucking amazing.
You can say this.
So about 3 years ago, I trained as an actor and was working as an actor. And just sort of almost by accident, really, like, stumbled into this world of, like, immersive theatre, or however the fuck you want to dress it up, whatever you want to call it. But, like, that's what it was when I sort of came to it, and worked as an actor with people like Secret Cinema, who are very well known, obviously. And then I did a show called Heist, and I was in that for about a year. And in that show, you physically ran around a huge building in Marylebone and you committed a robbery.
Wow.
And yeah, it was a lot of fun.
And the audience, it was like promenade theatre.
Yeah, so you run around and you, like, knocked holes through walls and, like, evaded guards and got locked up, and then you ended up in a room and you had to actually sort of, like, basically, yeah, steal the painting. Wow. Yeah, and then basically was sort of sick of being broke and sick of being an unemployed actor, yeah, and just got to thinking, what would I really want to do? Or what would I, if this burgeoning immersive theatre thing is real, and it is real because I've seen it, then what would I want to do? What thing would I want to do more than anything? Mm. And was drinking in a pub with some mates and came up with this idea of the Crystal Maze.
All the best stories start either on a stag do or in a pub.
Yeah, we were in a pub near Liverpool Street in London, and I find that between 4 and 6 pints is epiphany moment.
Yeah.
It's like you get, like, this rare clarity. And then after 6 pints, it's kind of diminishing returns. But
I find between 1 pint and 2 is where really good pool playing happens.
Yeah,
it's where I'm an excellent pool player. Yeah. Beyond 2, I can't play pool anymore. But yet when you reach 4 pints, that's when you go, why haven't we set up a business yet? Why are you talking to a mate you've not seen for 4 years and he's bored and he's a doctor?
We should look after rabbits.
Yeah, yes. That's exactly... Well, we'll come back. There's a number of topics. I'm going to start making notes of all the things I want to deal with on this podcast. Continue your story. Are you talking to mates?
So, yeah, and hit 4-pint clarity and just sort of announced that I was going to remake the Crystal Maze, and to sort of much derision from my mates. And woke up the next day, and the idea had stuck and was still there. And that was 3 years ago. So we have now remade the Crystal Maze, the London. So we've remade it as a live immersive experience that you can play for yourself. The idea being that it's your turn to be the star of the show. Mm-hmm. So we put the audience, we sort of take away the disconnect between sort of shouting at the telly box and the disconnect between a traditional audience sat in a dark theatre watching something.
Gone.
Yeah, it's fucking out the window.
Yeah.
The wall's out the window. And yeah, it's your turn to be the star of the show, and you come and you play the Crystal Maze exactly as it was. And the London venue's been open for a year, and we've just opened another bigger, better Crystal Maze here in Manchester, where we're recording today. And we co-produced the TV show last year with Stephen Merchant at Channel 4. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I suppose I'd have to agree with you. It is something worthwhile to have done. It's been a lot of fun.
So much to talk about. Where should we start? First of all, how much bigger and better is it than the London one? Because in the north, we enjoy anything that's bigger and better than London.
it's different. So there's 24 new games, entirely new games, and this time we went away from basically reimagining original games from the TV show, and we actually sort of went outside the box a lot more and basically created 24 new games that are at various levels of insanity. So there's one which is basically a life-size, human-size Space Invaders.
I didn't do that. Right, full disclosure, I've done the Crystal Maze in Manchester. It's at the old Granada Studios, and I got to go down there as part of the team from XS Manchester, which is a radio station that I do a show on. Tom invited us all down, and we got as part of the sort of previews to have a go. And it was bloody brilliant. I mean, and this is, I want to talk about this more as well. I find it very difficult to break up all my thoughts. I'm so excited to be talking to you. One of the things people who listen to this podcast know is that I'm a big Disney nut, and it's not that I've watched every Disney film and all that. I think as a business, what they've managed to do is obviously phenomenal. You can't deny that they've been quite successful.
They've done okay, yeah.
And one of the key turning points in Disney's history was where Walt Disney, who had made his company public, and it was therefore run by a board, were then much more involved, and he could be less controlling over the films. The films turned to shit for about 20 years. He went very miserable and kind of retired quite a bit into himself and started working on a secret project with selected people he called Imagineers from the animation departments and stuff, people he really liked.
Mm.
And they would work in secret sheds. It wasn't that secret, everyone knew who they were, but no one was allowed in unless Walt invited them.
Okay.
Set up a separate company to run that, which was called WED, Walter Elias Disney or something. Anyway, what they were working on began with his obsession for trains that went round his garden. He built a little toy train set around his garden, and they used that as a starting point. And what they created was Disney World, and that was kind of just like the first animated films that Disney made, where he was obsessive over the product. Every penny would be spent to make sure that this experience was the best possible for the audience. Well, the Profiteers got involved, and those middle films became less good. Meanwhile, he was using that obsession to create this next thing, and that was the next massive success. Another great example of it being successful. And the criticism that Disney World gets from people is kind of the word perfect is thrown at it quite a lot. You know, it's too perfect. You go, well, what? You can go in a hotel room and go,
this is too perfect.
Well, I want some shit in the corner. And so the long way around this is when I went to the Crystal Maze, a couple of weeks ago in Manchester, I truly thought, because I live in Britain and because there's very few examples of where our culture and our corporate culture at the moment really fund a product properly, fund the creation of a product. We get away with cheap versions of everything. I really walked towards that building and said to myself, right, practice saying how great you think this is, even though it's shit. You're going to be dragged around a bunch of rooms with, like, with the walls are going to fall over and it's going to feel, there's going to be like, I mean, I've done a lot of the escape room games and I love those things. But also they are thrown together by stuff you found in a charity shop. And there's that kind of, look, the audience is bringing a lot of imagination to this to make it great. With what you've done, it really is phenomenally great. The attention to detail is brilliant, down to if you have to take us up some stairs, the Crystal Maze music's playing as you're running up the stairs, down to the things that I noticed, the kind of things that Disney was obsessed with, was like the queuing systems. When you're queuing for a ride, there's a story that you're told as you're queuing, and the tiles on the floor are perfect. The floor isn't crap in the Crystal Maze. The corners, the doors work properly. They're proper latch doors. It's not... You've done it properly. You've designed it properly and made it a truly, a really good experience. And it costs, what, 50 quid to do something like that, is it?
Yeah.
Which sounds expensive at first, I think, to a lot of people. Go, well, 50 quid's a lot of money. But actually, if you think that escape rooms are like 15 quid and you're doing one room, and this is, you could be playing three rooms in every zone and having this whole experience, it's a brilliant price for a brilliant day out. That's my poster slogan.
Thank you. Thank you.
How much in the process of creating this, there must have been a million decisions where you could have made a cheaper decision.
Yeah. And thank you very much. I take the compliment. It's like myself, Ben and Greg, Ben Hodges and Greg Fittock, we're the three company directors, and we have invested an awful lot of time and effort and blood, sweat and tears and, like, you know, like hammering in nails and painting stuff when it needs to be done. And we also spent an enormous amount of money, like, on doing this, on getting it right. It is interesting you say about the Escape the Room games. I am just waiting for the one which is just, like, fully the Emperor's New Clothes, and you just walk into a fucking empty room and there's just nothing there. And it's like full imagination land. Yeah. Someone will do it. Some absolute genius charlatan will do it.
You're looking at him. the cogs are turning.
But yeah, no, we did spend a lot of money and a lot of time, a lot of effort. And, like, we also just, like, care about the individual's experience. And, like, at every point, as much as we can, we've put ourselves into people's shoes and thought, like, you know, is there going to be noise bleed into the next room? Like, is this Aztec atrium, does it really feel like walking into a clearing in a jungle in Mexico and seeing a temple? And, like, how do we control the light conditions enough to make it feel like it's bright and like it's actually daytime?
Sunny, yeah.
And, like, how do you control the heat in Aztec so that it's warm in there but it's cold in medieval, which has to be more like a baronial dungeon type thing? So yeah, like, we, you know, I mean, like,
yeah, you bridge the gap in those ways.
We tried to leave nothing, no stone unturned. And yeah, like, I mean, I look at what's out there, and I mean, we've got 24 escape rooms and four gigantic atriums, and, you know, like an Aztec scape and a Mars scape, and like, yes, you could sort of call £50 an expensive ticket price, but you know, you can go see a play that you've seen before and pay more.
Oh, yeah. A gig ticket. Someone was telling me they went to watch Drake a few weeks ago and paid 250 quid for the ticket.
I mean...
Like, what?
Yeah. To 20 Drake songs that all sound exactly the same.
Yeah. Well, no, Drake's amazing. What are you talking about? I'm not going to slag off the highest selling artist in the world. Be my guest, old man. Ask me to name one Drake song.
Hotline Bling.
Oh, yeah, that one. Yes. the before Drake, 50 quid sounds expensive. 50 quid sounds expensive. Full stop. For anything when people don't really know what they're going to be engaging with, you know. But your London one is like sold out for months, isn't it?
Yeah, I guess it was even in London. Like, I guess people, maybe it was a little prohibitive to begin with, like £50, and people were like, and like you say, your experience of it was like, Jesus, what is this going to be like? Is it going to be shit?
Exactly.
And like, yeah, like
it's
everyone
the testimonials.
Says,
it's the word of mouth and the testimonials that sell.
And then people come and see it and experience it, and they're like, oh my God, like. And they tell their friends, and yeah.
But you see, the reason 50 quid sounds expensive is because we live in Britain, is because of what I said. There is nothing that we spend 50 quid. You know, yes, you can spend 50 quid to go and see We Will Rock You, and it's shit. But most people think it's fine, you know. But if they were spending 50 quid to go and see, if they had access to Hamilton, the musical in New York, which you can't get tickets for, I haven't seen that because I can't get tickets for it. But if it was here, it would change the landscape. It would change the bar for what good entertainment is.
And I believe as well that it's because, again, immersive theatre, I don't want to, like, whatever you want to call it, but it is new. It is new. And so there isn't precedent and people aren't sure what it is. And there isn't this, like, benchmark of class.
Yeah.
But actually, I'd like to think ourselves and certainly people like Punch Drunk and Yumi Bum Bum Train, what they do is incredible. Like, it's incredible. It's of an incredibly high standard. And it's just as good, if not better, as other theatre and other traditional forms. But people think, well, you have to spend £100 to go and see a good West End show because that's what it costs. Mm-hmm. But I don't agree. I don't agree that it has to be that. And, like, I like the fact that immersive theatre is burgeoning and more people are coming to it and realising that you can go and have an absolutely mind-blowing experience for £50. Go and see a Punch Drunk show. Like, it's like being in a film. It's amazing.
I think what theatre has struggled, though, with, so you're talking about things that still a very, very small fraction of people will engage with. And little shout out for another podcast that I do for the Lowry Theatre. Recently interviewed the artistic director of the Birmingham Royal Ballet, David Bintley. And we were chatting, we got onto the state of theatre, if you like, and funding particularly, because the Birmingham Royal Ballet, have you ever seen the Birmingham
Royal
Ballet?
No, I haven't.
It's one of, you'll love it. It's one of the most phenomenal theatrical, well-funded, again, all of this, just really well-funded and so gets a really good audience. But the funding that they're getting to do that has been, like, slashed to the tune of 50%. He pointed out that Winston Churchill actually created the Arts Council because he recognised during the war the value of good art for people. And Thatcher came along, and in the Thatcher era, it was decided that theatre should pay for itself and we wouldn't subsidise these silly productions anymore, you know, plays and things like that. So what you get, the creation, is the West End Theatre. You get the profit-making, huge musical numbers, which, of course, there's a place for, fine, all of that. But as that's taken over, you also get what you and I would sit and watch and say, actually, you don't realise, but this is only cost them 20 quid, this set tonight, if you average it out, and we're all paying 100 quid a ticket, you know. And it's not that great a quality. What you've managed to do here, with the help of a well-known phrase like the Crystal Maze, you've managed to take immersive theatre to a mass audience. Potentially, you're taking it to a mass audience, and you could have made such shortcuts on that and made more money in the short term. But I think what you've created is something that will you can unfold this across every city in the country.
But I completely agree with what you just said, but I suppose I wouldn't necessarily take issue with the government, or, I mean, like, we should, like, collectively as a society, we should. But I also take issue with, like, in that there's got to be some responsibility for artistic directors and people who run theatres to
be profitable.
Not just go for the easy dollar and the easy money and the bums on seats, but actually, like, they have a responsibility to be makers of art and risk takers as well. And and not just do the same safe musicals and the same stuff. Mm. And like, I also think it's and not to sort of like get all like class structure on it, but
the last
like,
thing you said when you came into this room to me before we started was, "I'm not going to slag off theatres."
No, I'm not. But it's amazing over the last year, the amount of shows that I've gone to see, and it's always the same demographic of people, and that's like,
yeah,
white rich people.
Yeah,
and like I also think that like fundamentally that's not healthy and not good either, and like. That needs to be looked at.
The other podcast that I'm doing for the Lowry Theatre is called What is Dance? And it's trying to engage young people with all forms of dance. So I have spent the last 6 months and I'm spending the next 6 months exactly in what you're talking about. And the challenge for all of those theatres is you do have this established audience, which often is older and whiter and more middle class. And they will come and watch the classics. I sat and watched a Birmingham Royal Ballet piece, which was experimental. It was risk-taking. And it made me cry in the first 5 minutes. It was one of those... It was just phenomenal. There was no set. It wasn't a balcony scene. It was modern dance. And it was amazing. I had no idea what I was watching. And it just overwhelmed me. It was phenomenal. Mm. The audience that I spoke... Some of the audience around me that I spoke to left in the interval. And said, you know, I prefer the costumes, you know. And this is the problem that they've got, is that some people really are funding the product and really are taking risks. But how to get people, how to persuade people to come to the theatre once they're in their 20s or 30s, when their experience of theatre up until that point, like you say, has been of the same classics. It's the GCSE set texts, which are often done badly. Is really tough. That's the challenge, and let's go.
Like, yeah, but like for example, I grew up in Tottenham in North London, which is like not the best of areas. I'm sure like everyone will agree. And
yeah, it's horrible.
But there's no reason why like kids from Tottenham wouldn't go to the theatre and see a particular play and absolutely love it.
Yeah,
but. If you ask most like teenagers in Tottenham, like whether they'd go to the theatre, like they'd laugh in your face,
punch you in the face.
Yeah, exactly. but
let's do it. Let's go back to the beginning, right? Because I wanted to, so you went to drama school.
Yeah.
Which one did you go to?
I went to Mount View.
Mount View.
This is in Wood Green.
Wow, that's a proper musical tits and teeth type place, isn't it?
It is. Yeah, it is.
I went to the far more responsible Rose Bruford and studied directing. So I am better educated than Tom. Let's just make this clear. Tom was singing Les Mis songs while I was reimagining
Triple Beckett. Threat, though. Triple threat.
Can you dance?
Oh, I can dance.
Whoa. Okay, we'll have a dance.
I had to do a dance exam.
Did you really?
True story, yeah.
Oh, my God. What did you opt for, modern dance?
No, you had to do three dances. I had to do a waltz, a Cuban merengue, and a schottische, which is a classical Scottish dance.
Can you show me some Cuban merengue?
I would, but I've torn my ankle ligament, so I'll spare you that.
He just wears that. I know. To get out of doing the merengue in case it comes up. You can make all sorts of claims. It's I'm an astronaut, but I've got a cold. So
I'm going to put a Nike tick on this cast, by the way. Just so.
What? A Nike tick? Yeah.
Make it cool.
Put a NASA badge on it.
Or a Ferrari badge.
Yeah.
Go faster, boot.
All right. Theatre. This is the problem with theatre, right?
Right, okay.
Everything that you're talking about, the problems start at school. The problems start at about age... 5.
Because Shakespeare is poorly taught, or...
Shakespeare's poorly taught, but the reason Shakespeare's poorly taught is that every school in the world was created, every education system was created in the Industrial Revolution. It was created in order to make people literate enough to go to the factories and to... We were creating an organised workforce. as a result, all the subjects are in a hierarchy. So you have the sciences. If you think about how important the subjects were seen as at your school, I am absolutely positive you'll agree it goes science, maths, or math science. The humanities somewhere in the middle, the arts are at the bottom. And even within the arts, there's then a hierarchy. Music, kind of the most scientific, if you like, is at the top. Dance, drama, way at the bottom. My school didn't even teach dance and drama. It had to be a separate, you know, club outside school. And that's true of most people in any education system in the world. And in order for that industrial revolution system to work, you have to create a system whereby there are right answers and wrong answers. If you take a risk, if you think creatively, you will be in the wrong box. There is a correct answer to this problem, which will mean that you can then get the grades you need. In the arts, there are risk-taking and imagination, and those things are the thing that you're trying to encourage, which makes it so difficult even to sit within the education system. But the funding, the attention, the value that we as a country give to those things, like David Bintley said to me, he feels like he's had to apologise his entire life. I'm sure you've felt the same thing. Going to Mount View, you feel apologetic to normal people who do normal jobs. Oh, I go to drama school. It's like saying I'm a student is bad enough, but saying I'm a drama student, it's almost like, oh, I could get punched in the face for this in this country. Which actually,
Just like you're lazy or a bum, or like you don't want to do any work.
And how many hours a week did we do compared to our friends who went to normal universities? Oh my God, it's like 40 hours a week minimum of pretty strenuous stuff.
Yeah, well, I went to Sussex to do a BA in English Lit, and then did my MA at Mount View. And I did my MA at drama school was far more intensive than my BA in English.
It's a nightmare.
Which was basically like 4 or 5 contact hours a week.
And it's all that thing of the most advanced. I was saying to Stuart, who's outside here, who works with me, I was thinking the other day about if you saw a bunch of penguins or a bunch of giraffes doing a dance, and it wasn't to attract a mate, it was collectively line dancing. You'd think it was the most phenomenal thing ever. We'd be like, oh my God, have you seen this? As a species, one of the things that sets us apart is that we can create story and learn from story, but also just create things for fun and to make ourselves feel better that are artistic. In a way, the creative people, be it including architects and people who build houses and things, but the people who make entertainment purely for joy, are arguably some of the most advanced members of the most advanced species when it comes to thinking that we have. And yet, we are made from a young age to apologize and to think that this is something less worthy than being a builder, you know. So, all of that is to say that at school, there is no money, there's no attention put into what you're going to go and see at the theatre, what's good. The kind of productions that you get taken to see will be, we can name them between us. It'll be Willie Russell with Blood Brothers. It'll be Mice and Men, To Kill a Mockingbird, perhaps. It's the set text, the set GCSE text. And they are brought back in theatres for that result. They know they're going to get the kids in. And they're made on a small budget, and it's crap. And it's largely awful. And we are taught from a young age that plays and theatre, both because of education and the quality of the stuff we're watching, means shit.
And boring.
Boring.
Yeah.
That's the biggest thing, isn't it? This is dull. And I've seen young people watching Birmingham Royal Ballet who've never been to the Barrier Ballet before, or I've seen people watching well-funded piece of theatre, and they're blown away. Blown away. It's not that kids can't enjoy theatre. So you're just not making something that's actually worthwhile. So I think that's the problem that theatre has got, and it's partly that not everything can pay for itself.
But do you think that it's? I sort of feel like certainly that was the case, and I totally go along with that being born out of industrial revolution and necessity. But then, like, I do feel like in the 60s and stuff, and if you read about, there's an amazing biography of like Peter O'Toole and Ollie Reed and all those guys in the 60s, and like they talk about like going into acting and like everything being quite easy, and like drama schools were quite open, and like the plays and writing and stuff that was going on was all very exciting. And then the added sort of hilarity of it all is then they went on to be like complete lunatics as well, just like all the crazy stuff they got up to because they were allowed to.
And
people reveled in them being like crazy, wild alcoholic men.
Batshit.
But then it feels like, and like this book deals with it really well. It's like, it's kind of like what you were talking about with Walt Disney. It's like the money people and the, and because they also talk about that their adventures in Hollywood, and like in the 60s in Hollywood, like the film industry was quite wild and exciting. And then producers and money people sort of came in, and then like Ollie Reed today, if he was born today, there's no way he could get pissed on a film set.
No.
Because like someone would chuck him out and he'd never work again.
Yeah.
And like,
what a prick.
Yeah. But like it feels like yes, that certainly was the case in with the Industrial Revolution. But then there was like not a renaissance, but a movement towards like freedom of expression and like exciting stuff and like weird and wild stuff too.
It was a revolution.
Like, and then it's kind of feel like in this sort of reasonably nanny state world that the lid's been put on it again and everyone's sort of back in their box.
Yeah.
And like we've had a few like close calls with the economy and so like back to austerity and also like, and while you're at it, like, let's put a lid on your creativity and all that stuff. And if you want to do stuff, then fine, like do a musical and make a bit of money and play it safe, but don't do anything weird and wonderful.
Exactly. That's exactly what's
happening. And I kind of feel like we've sort of gone back a little bit, if that's even possible.
There's a brilliant documentary on Netflix that you should look up, and it's the Noam Chomsky one. And he talks about exactly what you've just said. The 60s, politically and across the board, was this moment of revolution. And governments had to really consciously think, well, democracy only works when you control the people to a large degree. Otherwise, democracy would just constantly overthrow. If it was a true democracy, no one would stay in number 10 for longer than 5 minutes, because it would be on a whim. So ways of controlling the people. And one of the ways that society has been controlled, and this is not conspiracy theories, this is kind of written in documents, that the way we do this is by making the new aims not spiritual or artistic aims. You make the aims capitalist ones that are about owning the best car, or you covet the things you see in adverts, basically. So you go, you create a society which lives not in reality but a hyper-reality. Ironically, I love hyper-reality like Disney World or the Crystal Maze. But we live in that world. So people aren't, they're not, most of us aren't activists now. Because although there's a great deal that we might be unhappy with, we've got just enough, and we've got Facebook, and we're able to go to Tesco and buy a hairdryer for 10 quid. And we've made the stuff of commerce very easily accessible. And those are the things which keep us happy. And they actively made that decision. The governments in America, studies were written for the government saying, this is how you stop all of these student protests and all of this stuff against the war and all of that. You need to make people aspire to a different type of thing. And even in big entertainment companies, they realize that the star, like Peter O'Toole or Oliver Reed, could demand whatever money they wanted because they were the name. And they've tried very hard to control that too. There are still some big stars, but I know, and I'm not going to say who, but I know that there are certain big corporations now in entertainment who will do everything they can to be able to not allow people to become stars. Mm. So you might change roles or the person who plays a role in, say, an animation or something.
Oh, so
like
as
that.
To sort of keep a
yes,
keep a
so that one person can't on monopolize a character or
okay.
So those kinds of thoughts exist where they go, how do we not create monsters?
Yeah, yeah.
And you can see that from a business perspective. You can totally see that. If you at the Crystal Maze made one guy your Richard O'Brien and the whole business rested on that one guy, you would start to go, oh my God, what's he going to ask for in year four?
Yeah, yeah.
But at the same time, you lose that magic that you're talking about. There's such the big stars that we hear now are often arseholes. Mm. You hear stories about there are certain very famous British people who have made it big in America and stuff. And I've heard many a story about those people that they are completely
just
horrible,
losing their way, yeah.
Horrible human beings. And so in order to get to the top, you have to be, rather than a lunatic like those people in the 60s, you have to be a dick.
Hmm.
And that's really sad because often those people aren't the most creative people and the most exciting people.
Hmm.
So what we come back to is this import.
I've
never used that word. What is important now is that companies recognize that, I think, that we're talking about. And
yeah,
go,
I mean, like, don't get me wrong. I'm not advocating like sort of anarchy and like going back to the 60s where everything was cool, man. But like, I think it's just, if I saw 10 things that were the same, then I'd go like, well, I want to do something else. I want to do something different. And I think a lot of just to go like so in real like layman's terms, like a lot of what's out there, be it TV or film or theatre, it's like, oh well, that's worked. Let's just do that again in a different way. Mm. And I read a really interesting article in The Guardian with Idris Elba, and it was actually about sort of the lack of opportunities for black actors in Britain. Mm. That's what the focus of the article was about. And the fact that Idris Elba, because he's a brilliant actor and is black and is successful, like that's often been forced upon him to sort of be like a champion for it. When and he doesn't really want to. And like, fair enough. Like, he's a human being and he can do what he wants.
Yeah, he hates black people.
Exactly. And actually, in talking about that, he brought up something that was quite interesting. And the interview was like, what do you watch on telly? And he was like, well, look, if I watch telly, put it this way, I'm not going to be watching a period drama, am I? and the interviewer was like, why? And he was like, come on, like British television's fixation with like one tiny, tiny, tiny segment of history, which is like basically Victorian England, is just bizarre. It's perverse. Like, and why is that? Well, most likely because Downton Abbey did really well, so let's just keep making different versions of Downton Abbey, watching posh Victorians shag each other. Like, it's just like, and like, I was like, yes, Idris, like, I'm totally with you.
Yeah.
Like, we have such a rich British history, like, and it's not just like of white Britain either. Like, there's a really rich sort of history in the last 50 years in Britain.
Whereas
lots of interesting stuff. And like, what should we do? Like, it's basically like posh period porn. Like,
yeah. And what they're doing instead is they're creating period stuff. Like, there was something recently, and I can't remember what it was, and it was set kind of medieval Britain. And they'd set it in the same old sort of period stuff. It was another Kings and Queens type thing. And they'd put in two or three actors of colour. And it was like, realistically, there is no way that these characters, these people, wouldn't have been white, right? So instead of, there's kind of this approach to it that is, instead of really empowering those different groups and different stories to tell great stories, we just create the same old shit and go,
and
let's make
it,
sure we have
and
diversity.
Call it colorblind casting whatever.
Yeah, and it doesn't make sense. It'd be like casting me and you in a piece about the pyramids and we're slaves climbing the pyramids.
There's this like new show out at the moment called Harlots.
I've not seen
it. And it's like, it's just like, I read another like really good article by this like feminist writer about it, and it's just like, it just started with like nonsense fact, like, 30% of women at this time were whores. And it's just that is the premise for this whole show. And it's basically like, let's get people in costumes shagging.
Hey, I'm not saying that's not true, but that's an amazing
start. No, I mean,
and it's not a comedy, no?
No, it's serious
drama.
Oh, my God.
30% of women were whores. Oh, my God.
And then just, proceed to have women whoring around for the next hour. Like, it's just, it's so bad.
There's something that goes through everything that we've discussed that I call the lottery winners. That is, when you do hear from Peter O'Toole or Oliver Reed or Tom Cruise, or you hear even people like you who are interviewed about doing awesome stuff like this, talk about how easy it was for them to do the thing they did. But actually, for every Peter O'Toole you hear, there might be 4,000 people who failed to do that. And they're the lottery winners. They're the people who are talking as if, oh, it was dead easy. I just bought a ticket and then you win. You know, and it's like, no, it's more complicated than that. And what were we just talking about? Oh, God.
Lots of stuff.
Literally the last thing you were saying.
Oh, the TV shows.
So with the Netflix model, so you get actually what it seems like what they're doing is funding the product in the same way you're funding the Crystal Maze. They fund the product really well. First and foremost, it's a really well-made thing. And that then finds a massive audience because people go, the quality of this thing is amazing. But it still involves the lottery winners. Like, still within that, there has to be some famous names. Brad Pitt has produced it, or there's somebody famous is starring in it, you know. So it's not... whilst we may sit and say, look, if someone wants to make a play in a local theatre in London, make the product amazing, and if you build it, people will come. Mm. Well, they won't necessarily.
Yeah.
You have the benefit of being able to call it the Crystal Maze, and so you're able to do that. Whether or not people would have come if you'd called it something else, well, Escape Room's an example of where they might have done. Diamond Labyrinth would have been great. and they might have done.
Bootleg.
No, that's what I'm just writing that down. That would have been great.
I think someone's going to do it now.
Maybe the only way right now in the current state of post-revolution creativity is that you need to go backwards and you need to find something. It has to be period dramas. It has to be the Crystal Maze. It has to be starring Keanu Reeves. If you're going to do something that you really want to fund the product and draw an audience to. But I think the like I said about the escape rooms, they've been incredibly popular. They don't demand a name or popularity. And I think there's hope. I think there's hope for whether people have the name Crystal Maze or not. I think there's hope. But
yeah,
I think it's important. I think the people who lead the way, like you and like the big theatres, you have led the way with this. You could have made something shonky and you didn't. You made something amazing. The theatres, if you have to put on a John Gobber play again, make it really, really good. Or, you know, if you're going to do Look Back in Anger for the 30th year running, Jesus Christ.
Yeah, so I am kind of faced with it again. I'm planning to basically adapt.
We're in the futuristic zone now.
Adapt and translate and bring over a very famous French play. It's famous in France and it has a massive sort of cult status in France. Mm. And I want to bring it here and introduce it to a British audience. And like that, for example, is going to be something completely original, completely new. It will never have been seen in English for starters and in Britain for seconds. But you know, I'm going to have to ask myself the same questions. Like, we'll probably have to get a big name in it to get bums on seats. Because, like, otherwise, you are always faced with that thing. Like, if you are the risk taker and if you are the person trying to bring something original, like, you have to face modern realities. Yeah. And it's like, I can't just shout about how wonderful I think this French, like, darkly comic satire is that's not going to be good enough. People aren't going to be interested enough. But if like Tom Hiddleston's in it, then like people will come and then they'll go, oh God, that was actually really good.
Yeah,
that was interesting.
Yeah,
I've never seen anything like that.
Yeah,
it's there are necessary evils even if you're trying to sort of do interesting stuff.
I quit theatre for despite the success, in a way. So I was doing a play that was, I cast somebody who wasn't particularly famous in a role, and it was a Dylan Thomas thing. It was an adaptation, and it wasn't a traditional thing. This was at Theatre Clwyd.
Mm.
Loads of people. We sold out. The full run was sold out, and the reviews said this is a theatrical watershed. And I looked out into the audience, and it was the same Blue Rinse Brigade that always came to the theatre.
Mm.
And that's the moment that I went, I'm going to do something else.
Yeah.
Because it was so sad.
But why? Why? Yeah, it just made you feel sad.
Well, it just made me feel sad that whilst that audience loved it, and I love those people for coming, mm. I'm not saying, you know, I've grouped them as the Blue Rinse Brigade, but what I mean is the regular theatre goers.
Yeah.
I would watch the play on a night that it was great, and I'd watch the play on a night that it wasn't. And the audience would love it the same.
Mm.
And I went, I want a more discerning audience. Mm. I want to find a way of getting people in who'll really be honest. And that's when I found radio and spent 10 years on the radio, because yeah. you're in people's cars, and if they want to call you a twat, they'll text you immediately or they'll turn off, you know. And that's the kind of, if theatre can engage, if theatre can think like, that's the problem theatre's really got, aside from all the political stuff.
Yeah.
When I directed, I always thought in the way that Brecht said, I always direct as if there's a blind man, a five-year-old boy, my father, and somebody else in the audience. And that's how you have to do it. You have to go, you may think that these people are captive. Theatre has treated the audience as if they're captive for so long that when an actor starts a two-page monologue, they expect the audience to be there at the end. And so there's no pace, there's no genuine energy to it, mm. and it just becomes self-indulgent.
Mm.
The best thing that could happen to theatre is that people learn that they're allowed to stand up and leave whenever they want, because then you've got to work for it.
Yeah,
which is
that
why.
That would be great.
Wouldn't it?
Just had a sign, like, encourage, if you think this is bored, shit, leave.
Yeah.
That would be great.
Just hear the sound of seats flapping up when someone's doing a boring yeah. speech.
Yeah.
But that's
weird. I'm glad you said that, because, like, I mean, there's always, like, you know, when, like, Hugh Jackman or Helen Mirren, who I hate, like there'll be some noise in the audience, or someone will, like, someone's phone will ring.
Yeah.
And, like, they'll get so indignant.
There's a story
and, like,
that comes out.
I'm fucking acting.
Yes. Yeah.
Like, how dare you?
Yeah.
And it's like, actually, no, how dare you?
Yeah.
Like, you need to fucking keep these people
yeah.
entertained.
Yeah.
Like, this isn't... And actually, like, the one thing that I say to the actors at the Maze is, like, this isn't about you.
Yeah.
This isn't like, I'm going to do some acting in your FaceTime. This
yeah.
isn't, like, this isn't my show.
Yeah.
Like, you're there mm-hmm. to allow these people, for them to be the star of the show.
Yeah.
You are there to facilitate them
yeah.
being the show and having a good time. And, like, as soon as they get that,
yeah.
then it's like, you unlocked it for me. Like, thanks, I know how to do this now.
That, and that's, like, that's... I noticed that with the guy who was our Richard O'Brien, who was taking us around.
Mm.
He was so, you know, yes, he was playing a part, but the part was very close to who he was. It's not awkward when it starts again. I was like, oh no, we're going to have to put up with an actor who's trying to do a
yeah.
performance. I'm going to have to laugh awkwardly.
Yeah, yeah.
Actually, no, he was doing exactly what you just said. And that's where theatre's gone wrong.
Mm.
Great friend of mine, Russell Gomer, who's a really good comic actor, said to me once, the best thing you can do is you have your lines in half of your head and you learn all the thing, but you must keep half the head blank. If you keep half the head blank and aware and ready to react and change and work with the audience, wherever it is.
Yeah. You've got to learn it and then forget it. And then
yeah.
walk on stage and as if you've forgotten it.
And be ready. Be ready
yeah.
to enjoy it. And
yeah.
and yeah, make it about the audience.
Yeah. And some of our actors are absolutely incredible at doing that.
Yeah.
And, like, also the thing that's nice about it is it's just you're just talking to other human beings.
Yeah.
Just go in the room. They're all human beings. Like,
yeah.
so
yeah.
are you.
Yeah.
Believe me.
Mm.
Just go and do it. Just go and talk
yeah.
to them. And, like, actually, so that is in large part why I wanted to get into immersive theatre, because when I was doing it and in it, I saw new audiences coming to it. And now that we're producing a show,
mm.
like, we are, there is a new different groups of people out there, and
mm.
like, we don't just get older rich white people coming
mm.
to see our show. In fact, that's probably the smallest demographic we have. Like
yeah.
we get all sorts
yeah.
old, young, groups from different part of the country, yep. stag do's, hen do's, like all kinds of different groups of people.
Yeah.
Like a group, like when I was doing it, there was a, like one day I did like 10 shows, like we had one group of like proper geezers from Essex and then next like some like sort of quirky East London arty types and like, that's so interesting to me. Yeah, and that's why we're sort of doing it, because it's like, well, it should be for everyone. Yeah. And then the reason I said the thing about Tomlin earlier is because like my brother's younger and like sort of, you know, used to run with like some not too clever people. Yeah. And like they'll happily watch like Top Boy on Channel 4 and think it's fucking amazing.
Yeah.
But like, you could do a show like Top Boy as a play and they'd love it.
Yeah.
They'd absolutely love it. But you just need to sort of make them understand that. Like and that I don't know. That I don't know how to do. But I'd be up for trying.
Yeah. Let's do it.
Yeah. I'd love to do stuff like that. And not just, and also like not just, I mean like the Royal Court and places like that try really hard and they do really well and they open up sort of like boutique theatres in other parts of London, but like you can't do it and it be like a fucking like community project or like it can't feel like a charity project or something. Like it would have to be like a massive level of investment, really fucking good, and like
the problem is the funding that does exist to support projects. You do have to appear like that. I set up a community radio station 10 years ago, and our approach was this has to be professional. It has to sound awesome. It's aimed at young people in Knowsley. If it doesn't sound bloody brilliant, they won't listen to it.
Mm.
And it's in some ways that makes it harder to get funding than the community radio stations that sound awful.
Yeah,
because the ones that sound awful are very clearly ticking boxes to the naked ear, you know.
Yeah.
Is it anyway? There's some.
But like, if you got it right, like it would be brilliant. Like, in the way that like Dizzy Rascal or whoever's gonna do a sellout show at the O2. Like, there's obviously like there's people that want to go and listen to Dizzy Rascal music. But like, then like do a project that attracts like kids from poorer areas in London, or do a play, but not as a fucking community project, but like as just an excellent play, like as just like a brilliant piece of theatre, and like God knows how you make it feel cool and relevant, and you break down those social barriers, but like that would be amazing. That would be absolutely amazing.
I suppose what you do is you create a phenomenal all singing, all dancing, brilliant piece of theatre that you know is really good, and you are willing to rent one building, put it in it in the middle of Tottenham for a year, and you're willing to lose the money that costs, and you put it on every night for a year, and you just wait. You just do what you've done with the Crystal Maze.
Yeah.
You just go, you know what, if 3 people come in the first week, 6 people will come in the second week.
Yeah.
If it's that good.
Yeah.
And that's the kind of distance that it takes, I suppose, to really grow something like that. But very few people are going to fund that up front. Very few people are going to go, well, I'll lose money on this. How Hollywood exists the way it does. You know, you need to stand in front of the people with the money and say, this is the idea and it's going to be a winner from weekend one. If it doesn't make its money in weekend one, it's dead, you know.
Yeah, I mean, that's just horrible as well, isn't it?
Yeah.
Robert Redford was saying last year that, like, it's just... He's shocked. He's shocked that there's like that no one's willing to like write a story.
Yeah.
It's like where are these people that write stories? Yeah. Like what's happened to them?
Yeah.
Why are we having Fast and Furious 8?
I know.
There's 8 of them.
Well, that's where Disney again is in a really interesting place because of Pixar coming along and joining them. We're having such a good time. Let's stop the discussion now. Come back to this next week in a part 2.
All right, agreed.
Okay, more
absolutely
from Tom next week as we try and find the crystal in the sand. Forget it. See you next week.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus,
Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.